chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. Happy New Year from Technology Partners and the Something Extra podcast team. We have had such an amazing time bringing the show to you week in and week out. We wanted to share some of our favorite moments from 2022. Sit back and enjoy. And as always, thank you for being the best part of Something Extra. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I had stumbled across the Lead with Love video that was released, I think, in 2020. That video brought me to my knees. It is so powerful.
Prior to us connecting this morning, I sent your folks a picture of the Christmas box that P&G just sent to all of its employees and all of its retirees. And that box, the graphic on it, had one piece of information. It said, "Lead with love." This is a secular company, the number one advertiser in the world, who understands what's going on in the world. And they need people to buy their products. And the way that they do that is they have to be able to relate to who people are and what they're going through. The fact that this secular company would send out a holiday package that is admonishing every single person, no matter what their phase of life is, how they're connected to the company, their societies, their communities, you have to lead with love. And what does that practically mean? That idea about lead is putting others ahead of yourself. And it ties to an insight I have. So P&G sponsored my PhD, and my area of specialty was leadership. I wanted to understand if P&G at that point was rated the number one company in the world for leadership, I wanted to understand it at a DNA level. And here's the number one piece that I discovered in it, and everyone needs to catch this. 70% of the employees in all the companies that we looked at 20 years ago did not trust their boss. And I was so blown away by that statistic. And when I dug into the details of it and did further research on it, the discovery was employees do not feel like their boss cares about them. And they don't care about them because they don't know the name of their spouse. They don't know the name of their kids. They're sending emails. They're sending texts on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, over the holidays, over their vacations. And the employees were like, "I'm just a cog in the wheel. No one really cares about me." And I say that if you're a manager over somebody, your personal goal has to be, I'm going to show them love. And love means I'm going to respect them at such a level that they're going to know that. And this sounds manipulative, and I don't mean it to be so, but here's the result of it. When you show someone that you really care about them, in fact, you love them, guess how hard they work for that company? They understand that they're part of a team, and that team comes alongside each other in the most difficult moments. Yes, business has its difficult moments, but if you don't show that you care for them, if you don't love them, guess what they believe about you? That you're using them. And the result is you will never get the best from them.
So I would love just to dig in a little bit. One of the things that you say is most of the time management experts talk about workspace productivity, but you are describing grace-based productivity. Can you tell our listeners the difference?
The world doesn't necessarily need another time management book. There are 60,000 time management books on Amazon right now. I've read pretty much all the perennial bestsellers, given my background as an entrepreneur. Yeah, two really big problems with those books, and you've already hit on the first one here, Lisa. Most of these books tend to be centered on this idea of works-based productivity. The message is, you're feeling swamped and overwhelmed, follow my system, and you got to do it perfectly. And then at the end of this road, you're going to find peace, right? Well, here's the deal. Putting your hopes in any author's system, any worldly system, is going to fail you at some point. You got to find peace in something that is secure. For me personally, that's been my relationship with Jesus Christ. And the Bible says in Romans 5:1, I have peace with God through Jesus Christ. So I don't do time management exercises in a wild goose chase to get peace. I do it in response to the foundational, secure peace that I've already been given and found in a secure place, right? So that's the first problem I'm really trying to solve with this book, Lisa. But if I can just touch on the second problem, you mentioned these seven principles. And these aren't just seven time management principles. These are seven principles that I believe we can see in the four biographies of the most productive person who has ever walked the earth, Jesus of Nazareth. Christian or not, I think it's pretty hard to dispute that Time Magazine's person of the millennium is not the most productive person who ever walked the earth. And we've got these four biographies. They're Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the first four books of the New Testament of the Bible that show us how he lived his day-to-day life. And of course, they don't show him with a calendar, right? Or a to-do list, but they do show Jesus seeking to find solitude so he could think clearly and be creative. They show him dealing with distractions at work. They show him seeking to be busy without being hurried. In other words, they show him dealing with the exact same challenges that we face today. We don't have to wonder how the author of Time manages time. It's right there in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So I looked at these biographies through that lens and said, okay, what are the timeless time management principles? That's the seven principles of this book. And then map them to, as you said, these 32 wicked practical practices to help us live out those principles in our modern context.
That's what had me, because I'm like, I believe, just like you just said, he is the most productive person. I mean, he created a movement that's still going. And I'm like, why wouldn't I rather learn from him? And what did he do? You know, and as a follower, that's what we're doing, right? We're trying to follow him. One of the things you say here is time stewardship is a command. You know, we need to reclaim our time from useless pursuits and employ it to the glory of God. And I just love that. But you're very first principle is start with a word. And I mean, I understand that some of our listeners may not subscribe to this belief, but you know, it find what works for you, right? But you know, having a quiet time is the first practice of that.
Yeah. Again, regardless of your religious beliefs, starting your day in quiet solitude is a wise practice, because solitude and silence helps us think clearly, helps us be more creative, et cetera, right? Here's the second thing I would say. I think all of us would be wise to start our days rooting ourselves in our values and our principles, in the things that are going to outlive us. All of us want our work and our lives to matter long after we're gone. And if that's true, we got to be rooting our minds and our days in a narrative that will outlive us. And for me, part of what draws me to the Christian faith is that the Christian Bible says that the things I do in my work today, even the physical things I create, have the chance to last forever. I can't even begin to describe how inspiring that is, because I think that hits at something deeply human that we all want. In the words of Hamilton, I want to build something that's going to outlive me.
Yes.
And the Christian narrative says that that's true. And so rooting myself in that reminds me of the value system that I've subscribed to, that I want to dictate how I spend my time the rest of the day.
I just recently read a stat, 70% of family-owned businesses fail or they're sold before the second generation takes over. 10% won't even make it to the third generation.
Yes.
So that is pretty incredible to now be on the third generation? I mean, what would you say would be the secret of that with you guys?
Well, I could see how that happened with us, because I had no intention necessarily of going into the family business when I got out of college. I didn't know what I would do. I had some other plans, and my children did not either. When I went through my transformation in my life, beginning in 2000, when I was 47 years old and took my sabbatical, we realized that I was working really, really hard, but not loving it anymore. And that I needed to reconsider my life mission and the mission of the company that would be so exciting that it would give me joy to wake up in the morning and go to work, that I would be excited about the next project. And I came to the conclusion that if I had to build another efficient office building box, I would just die. I would never do another one. I'd rather close down the company. And so when our executive team got together, Lisa, and we considered what did we want our new mission statement of the company to be, we said, let's simplify it so we all know what it is. We came to the conclusion we wanted it to be three words. We wanted it to inspire, impress, and improve. We want to inspire people with the beauty of our projects, impress them with the excellence of their experience, and we want to improve the lives of everyone we touch. And if a project doesn't impress us and inspire us and improve the lives of other people, we're not going to build it. We'll go on to the next one. It doesn't matter if it's the most profitable project on earth. If it doesn't inspire, impress, and improve the lives of others, we've decided we will just pass respectfully.
Yeah.
And that changed the direction of our company, and it changed the quality of what we built, and it changed the inspiring nature of what we delivered in communities. And that is important because that inspired my son to want to come to work for the company, and my daughter and my other daughter to want to work for the company, because they saw they could be a part of something that really turned them on.
There's no shortcut to being courageous. You have to practice courage, and courage will unlock all the other traits. That is so beautiful. Have you seen that in yourself?
You do. I think there is so much to unpack when you are born in a different country and you're trying to establish yourself as a community member, you know, as a professionally and as a mom. And there is definitely a journey to finding your voice. This is just me talking about myself. I know it's different for everybody. Some people are just blessed that they know how to do it, but I had to work at it. I really did. I think growing up, I think I can talk a lot, but I do sit back and listen and observe, and that is very much my personality. I would do too much of that. There was a point in my life I had to really make a choice to say, okay, I have thoughts, I have ideas. If I don't start to feel comfortable actually being vocal about it, Then what's the point? Then I can't share this with everyone. And it had to be a very conscious choice to practice that. And to me, I think actually bringing voice to your thoughts takes courage also.
Yeah.
For me anyway. And so when I did that, it was horrible at first because I couldn't get it all together properly. There's practice that is needed. And I think opportunities to share your opinion. Sometimes, you know, you do have to be succinct. You really do have to simplify your message, and that takes time. So there's courage in acting, but I'm specifically talking about courage in your voice, making them known and using that to influence. And I think it takes practice. And unless we don't do that, I think all of the other traits are unlocked when, first of all, you have to unlock courage for whatever it is that you want to do, whatever you stand up for. So
that's beautiful. Well, Manisha, this is Something Extra. And I know you have a couple of something extras. What do you believe are the something extras that every leader needs?
I have two. I'm going to pick two today. I think leadership is such a privilege because there could be so many people in that spot that are competent enough to have your role, but it's you. And so what are you going to do with it? So I always say, practice being an advocate for your team, right? Not just think it, but actually learn to show it. They should know visually through your words, through your interactions, that this person's got our backs. So yeah, I mean, it's very obvious, but I think you'll form good, strong teams, and getting talent, everyone knows, is hard right now. And so you really do have to develop into that advocate for your teams. And then second one, I think this is close to my heart, but learn to simplify. It's hard to do. Simplifying a message, simplifying processes. Time is precious. I would rather teams take time to do things together, to bond, to go out and get lunches versus spending time in things that's not worth the time. So however you can simplify work, simplify messages, simplify the business, we got to do that. And it's not as simple as it sounds. It takes a lot of thought.
You know, the world will change. So the important thing is we need to change with it, right? So, but a couple of things that you said in here that I'd love to camp out on for just 1 minute. You said, what can help when you don't know where you're going? Here are five things. Maintain a non-anxious presence. That is so important. With what we've gone through in the last 3 years, our people are looking to us. And if we are anxious, then that's going to trickle down into our people. So in fact, you say people are looking for leaders, for a lack of a better term, hinged. And I never heard that before. What do you mean by that?
Well, most of us become unhinged. So I kind of made that up. Like, we want to be hinged, not unhinged. And the non-anxious presence idea comes from a rabbi, Edwin Friedman, a number of years ago. Another leader I follow, Steve Cuss, said, anxiety spreads in a room. So what will often happen is if you have an anxious person in the room, that anxiety is contagious, almost like a virus, right? And so you get one worked up person, everybody gets worked up. And it's pretty clear that none of us really knew what was going on, especially in 2020. And I think one of the secret scripts of leadership is most of us are making this up as we go along. Do I really know what I'm doing? I don't really know what I'm doing. Like, this was a hobby a decade ago. I started writing and then I started the podcast just because I enjoyed it. I didn't expect 20 million downloads. I didn't expect, you know, a website that gets accessed millions of times a year by leaders around the world. Like, I didn't expect that. So what I had to do is I had to build a company. So now there's a team of 9 of us and we do this because I can't do it all myself. And then, you know, we blew up our business model recently too, because we saw that what we had been doing for 3 or 4 years was starting to level off. And before it leveled off and before we went into decline, we said, okay, we're going to do it a different way. And we blew that up. But honestly, most of us know this, right? Like, even if you're in the C-suite, you're like, how did I get here? You know, unless you really have an ego problem, you kind of go like, I feel unqualified. I feel like I'm a bit of an imposter. And that's normal. But I think what you have to do is just say, okay, we got here. We're going to get out of this. I'm a person of faith. I believe God has a sovereign plan for the world, even though it doesn't look like it most days, and for our lives. And so what I can do is I can be calm. I'll give you a very practical example because that sounds very ethereal. You know, I've been learning financial principles over the years, and we bootstrapped our business. And we always believed in a cash reserve because you got to be prepared for a rainy day. Well, in March of 2020, it rained, it poured, it stormed. And when everybody was laying off, I sat down with my CFO, went over all the financials, saw that we had a cash runway that could extend into the fall. And I called all my team together via Zoom. We'd been on Zoom for years because it's a virtual company. And I just said, nobody's getting laid off. All right, we're going to figure this out. I don't know what's going to happen. The bread and butter of our business is course sales. I don't know whether anyone's going to buy a course or not, but we got cash in the bank. Nobody's losing their jobs. Well, everybody just relaxed and they all kind of leaned in. And then we tried to figure it out and we pivoted, and like everybody did, and we innovated. And we said, well, let's do a free course. So we did a free course. And then 15,000 people took that free course. It was amazing. It was a real gift. I shot it on my iPhone because you couldn't even have a crew in to shoot it. And then we said, okay, well, let's shoot another product that we called the 30-Day Pivot. So we shot that course, again, very low budget, but let's get that out to market. And we don't know what the market is. So we tested it and we said, we'll make it $77, like almost free. And it sold like crazy. And then we're like, okay, now we can figure out what about our regular courses, which are usually at the $300 or $400 mark. Well, there was a market for those too. So we figured it out, but we had that. And I think that lack of anxiety, was I nervous on the inside? Sure, but anxiety spreads. And so we were able to assure the staff, get everybody leaning in. And I'm really proud of what the team did in those first few months of the pandemic, because a big chunk of my income was speaking. And of course, that got shut down. I live north of Toronto. The border was closed for 18 months for all intents and purposes. So that got wiped out. So we pivoted to virtual. With that kind of thing, you can get to innovation pretty quickly. But if you're freaking out and your hair's on fire, your whole team is going to feel that. And some of them will say, I got to jump ship. I got to leave. This is too stressful for me. And people have stressful enough lives too. So you want to maintain that non-anxious presence.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
On January 15th, 2009, you had an experience that basically, let's see, what do you call it? It's the point in time that changes everything.
It's called my pitch. Point in time that changes everything.
And you were sitting in seat 15A. It was Airways flight 1549. It was January 15th. There's a little bit of significance.
15 to... follows me. Yes, correct.
Yeah. So what does 15 mean?
Being a leader, one who leads. And one who adds value.
I'd love for you to tell our listeners, for those who haven't heard the story, you've seen the movie Sully. That was about the pilot, right? Who was a veteran pilot. And if you guys had not had him as your pilot, who knows what would have happened, Dave. He pulled some tricks out of his bag. But tell us the story about what happened on January 15th, 2009.
You know, January 15th, 2009 was just an ordinary day. Travel day, business day, end of a three-day business trip. You think you're trying to get home to your family early, you know, trying to surprise them. That's good stuff. Until something happens that changes not only that day, but everything. When all of a sudden you hear an explosion on the plane and you're like, I've never heard that on a plane before. And then you look out the window and you see fire coming out. Like, I've never seen that on a plane before. And you start banking. Okay, we're just going back to the airport. All of a sudden, like, you see the skyline of Manhattan up close. And like, I've never seen that before. And all of a sudden, you look out, you see a bridge coming. Like, uh-oh, we're not going to clear this bridge. And something's really seriously happening. And then you hear the captain say his famous words, is your captain braced for impact? And now you know something serious is happening, because he only cleared the bridge by roughly 400 feet on a 600-foot bridge. So we're roughly 1,000 feet at that point, crossing over. You look down, people's faces are looking up, and you're like, whoa, we're really close. And that's the moment you realize you're probably not going to make it, because you're going straight nosedive right into the river. And Canley, I've never seen a plane crash survive going into water. So basically get everything buttoned up really quick. It's like, you know, you do your final request, and because it may not happen, but all of a sudden you get down and you make it. Hooray for the captain. You did an amazing job, but now you got another problem. The plane's sinking in a river, and it's 36 degree water, and it's 11 degrees outside. And now you got to get out of a sinking plane. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, everybody's moving and I get my time to go. But all of a sudden, something changed that day for me. That was the first moment of the pitch. I talked about the point in time. That was the first moment, because when I got to the aisle and I was going out that door at 10F, I'm like, I hear my mother. My mother passed away, as you heard earlier, in 1997. But I heard her say in my head, yeah, if you do the right thing, God will take care of you. And see, my mother never lied to me. So, you know, I had to make a decision. I tell people, these are the decision points you make. You got to make a decision. You can either go, that's okay, or you can do something. So I climbed over the seats towards the back of the plane to see if anybody needed help.
Your motivation is ministry, your method is business, and your message is Jesus. 2021, you guys celebrated 50 years in business. You said the motivation hasn't changed, the message hasn't changed, but the methods have had to change, right? Because the world continues to change.
When I took over my role here as the leader in 1994, you know, I was this young business kid that, you know, I love Jesus, but I was a business guy. And the two fellows that had been the founders of the business and some others that, you know, were pastors. So when I took over, people began to ask, well, now are we going to move from 80% ministry and 20% business to 80% business and 20% ministry? I remember hearing that and I thought, well, Lord, no, nothing's really changing. Our heart is still ministry. And I got away one afternoon and was taking a walk and just praying about that. And the Lord just spoke to me as clearly as he ever has. And he said, no, our motivation is still ministry. We want to do what we can in our generation to make Christ known. That is our heart's cry. And our message is still Jesus. We just present Jesus in 6,000 different ways through the products and the tools and the resources we make. That doesn't change. But our method of business, you know, is changing constantly. And, you know, I always tell people we're not a church and we're not a parachurch organization. We're a business. We're a for-profit business. And to be able to adapt, I call business a full contact sport. I mean, it is tough to stay in business because people, you've got to make a product and a service that people want to get their wallet out and spend their money on, right? And really make that happen. And so how do we adapt our business model to really stay competitive and to be excellent? You know, our values at DaySpringer, based on the acronym PRAISE, you know, we talk about prayer is at the foundation of what we do, and respect of the individual, attitude of service, and integrity and honesty, and then stewardship. And then we end with excellence. I call it the bookends around prayer and excellence. Is we believe that whatever you do, do with all of your heart. If we can be excellent in business, it gives us a platform with which to share Jesus in different ways and do that effectively. So that really, when I came back and shared that with my team and people across DaySpring, that really resonated. And at the time, I did not know that would become sort of the essence statement of what we've been about this last 27, 28 years. And that's been a really guiding principle to keep those stakes in the ground. That motivation and that message are still the same. Those never change. But with inside those stakes, then how do we stay competitive in the business world to serve consumers and to make a difference in the lives of people?
Tell our listeners a little bit, because it's the offense. You figure out what your offer is, the offense, and then the intersection of that, your social legacy. So tell us a little bit more about offer, and then we'll go into offense, because, you know, I told you about the 17 sustainable development goals and things like that. I think it will really help our listeners.
Yeah, to me, this absolutely is something extra. And the something extra I'd say is something we all think about and embrace to varying levels, but perhaps we don't put words to. And I really believe there is a deep power to words. So the framework is really simple, but by filling out each of the thoughtful exercises, my desire is that this isn't a book or an anthology of stories you read. It sparks action and it sparks intention, because I do believe I fell into something, but I would love for others to learn from me and start much earlier, because these younger generations, they are so switched on. They want to lead with intention. They're asking purposely now, what do I want to live for? I think it's extraordinary. I didn't start asking these questions till much later in my life. So the simple model is there's an offer and there's an offense. Your offer is that unique package of who you are and the value you uniquely bring, whether it is your resources, perhaps time and money, your experiences, your skills, or your personality traits. What is that bundle that uniquely makes you you? And then on the other side, there's your offense. And that is the thing that calls to you more than anything else. We're offended by a lot of things. I try to never use plastic bottles. That offends me. But does it literally stop me in my tracks and make my heart race? No, that's probably not my offense. It bothers me, and I'm going to do what I can to always use a cup. But my offense is vulnerable, marginalized, and hurt children. That's why when I was younger, I studied science, because I wanted to be in pre-med. And you know, I realized this passion that called to me maybe doesn't mean it becomes my career, my professional career, but it's something I can meaningfully contribute toward in my life. So if I define my offer and my offense, the intersection becomes what I call social legacy. And the reason I picked this phrase is it's a little bit more intentional. It's more precise than purpose. Legacy simply means you're leaving something better than you found it. And social defines the space in which you want to have that impact. So my social legacy is good kibun. It's a Korean phrase that one of our spare room guys taught me, which is comfort for the spirit. And actually, it harkens back to our previous conversation about a sense of belonging, because isn't that what a comfort for the spirit is? When you walk in my home, if you can feel that your spirit is at peace, wow, that is the nicest compliment anyone has ever paid me. And it made me become more intentional about the kind of house that we're renting right now, about the furniture that I choose. Maybe I won't have the fanciest or most elegant, but it'll really be comfortable. And then I realized this transcends into work. That's what I want work to be. I want it to have great kibun. You know, I came into one of our agencies. A young girl was just white in the face as I walked in with her. And I remember asking her, are you okay? She said, well, this happens every day I come into work. My heart starts racing and I can't catch my breath. She was literally feeling immersed in anxiety the minute she walked in. And I was brand new. And I said, what can we do to make that stop? How do we help you feel differently? And she said, well, what would differently be? I said, you come in and it's the opposite. You feel like you can shrug all the burdens off and there's a sigh of relief because you're here. She said a sad thing. She said, I've never felt that in any workplace. And it really just charged me up. And I thought, that's going to be my workplace. You're going to come in and go, yes. And, you know, we've just come off of 3 months of lockdown, not normal lockdown, like house arrest lockdown in Shanghai. And people couldn't wait to get back to work. They were itching. And the day they came back, they celebrated. That probably happened all over the world. But here, people were deeply joyful that they got to be back at McCann. And I feel like, okay, we're starting to do something right here.
I see so many, I'm around so many leaners, and so many times, Ken, people are hard charging. It's like, accomplish more, got to do more. And sometimes it's just, I've got another friend that says, you know, finding joy in the moment.
Lisa, we have two cells. We have a task-oriented cell, so used to getting jobs, and a thoughtful, reflective. Which one goes, wakes up first? Well, it's the task-oriented. The alarm goes off, and John Ortberg, who's an old minister buddy of mine, he said, why don't we call it the opportunity clock, or it's going to be a great day. But alarm, you know, geez, you jump out, you know, and you're eating while you're trying to wash, and you jump in your car and all racing all around. You get home at night, you don't have energy to even say goodnight to somebody who might be lying next to you. The next day, boom, you're out. And so you're caught in this rat race, you know, that even if you win, you're still a rat. So one of the things that I really try to work on, and I think we all should, is in the beginning, enter your day slowly, prayer and study of scripture or reading inspirational stuff or just meditating or doing something that just gets you focused and think about your day and how you want to be in this day. And then I like to write at the end of the day, praisings, what did I do today I'm proud of, and redirects, what would I like to have redone? And so who is it that said a life unexamined is not worth living? I think it was Plato or one of those.
Plato or Socrates, yeah.
Those young guys.
Yeah, I love that. The problem with being in a rat race is even if you win the race, you're still a rat. I mean,
so you just want to be more intentional about your life, not have your life drag you along.
Ken, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
The biggest something extra is to get out of your own way. And to realize that you're not the center of the universe, that you're only as good as the people you gather around you. And if you make and help your people look good, they'll help you look good. And it's a win-win-win. You know, it's a win for you. It's a win for them. It's a win for your organization. It's about we, as we said, not me.
How important is it, do you believe, to engage not only the person's mind, and their hands, the work of their hands, but their hearts?
It's foundational. You know, I've heard the slogan, though, we're a people first company. I think companies say that, but the best leaders figure out how to connect that heart. And for me, my secret recipe is really two things. It breaks down in every offsite. I have my leaders rank, how did we do on these two things? I think it's a combination of value and fun. And from a value, it's making sure that everybody understands how they are adding value, right? Why does their work matter? How does it connect to the overall mission? Those things are so powerful because there's very few people that want to come to work and just, you know, write a line of code. But when they know that line of code is going to, you know, affect the lives positively of people or operators in the restaurant or whatever it is, and they see that come to light, it means so much more, right? I think the flip side of that coin on value is ensuring that they're getting value too. So people like myself, we want to learn, we want to grow, right? And how are you making sure that they have the work in order to do that? And you're stretching people appropriately and giving them those opportunities to grow. And so I think that's the first part of how do you connect the hearts and minds to the mission. I think the second part, and you know, I'll steal a quote from the late Randy Posh, who was a professor at Carnegie Mellon. If you haven't watched, he had a last lecture at CMU before he passed away. And one of the key things that he says is never, ever underestimate the importance of having fun. And I saw that in my parents and everything they love, that's been a core component in my leadership. Whether it's, I start every town hall with a trivia, right? Like random facts about the company or about the industry or whatever it is. You know, we had a team building offsite and, you know, the goal was to understand the QSR industry. And so we broke everybody up into teams and they went out and did a scavenger hunt. Like really incorporating fun and not forgetting your childhood, you know, and bringing that in and making sure that's a core tenet of the culture that you're building is a differentiator. Those are the memories that you create and the stickiness you create.
I have an accident. We could get a ticket. We could get the finger. You know, that's if you're making it, you could get that. But if you make a mistake listening, it's not always obvious until often we have a big mess on our hands.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It's death by a thousand cuts in relationships. We might hear you're not listening, but we don't necessarily even hear that all the time as the real horn or the real warning sign. Just to go back to tying that into the title, the reason I went against a lot of marketing or medical advice, as I like to call it, to name the book a problem instead of a solution. What is it costing you not to listen? My opinion is you can't solve a problem you don't know you have. And because we're not taught how to listen, we're told from a very young age, why would we know this is a problem? Why would we know we're not driving well if we were never taught to drive? That's kind of what we're doing. And the subtitle was as hard for me to kind of describe as the title, because I know the word understanding, people get it, but what it can really do for you is help you connect, right? It also earns you the right, because that's part of what conversations are about, is earning the right to solve a problem or sell a solution or give advice or to influence somebody. And we tend to rush to that before we've really earned that right. And that's why the Covey quote's so powerful, because when we understand first, then we really get the permission slip more so to do that. And that's what I wanted to help people learn how to do.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. You know, I just thought that this was so interesting. On page 56, you've got some stats here. And in business, you know, you say 40 to 80% of your time in business is really supposed to be listening, right? But the years of training is zero.
Zero. Crazy, right?
Zero. Crazy. Zero.
Crazy. This and but it's off it when I've asked people how important is listening or is listening important, universally the answer is 100% from every level of the organization is a resounding yes. Nobody's disagreeing with that. But the interesting thing is it's assumed instead of taught, like walking. We have legs, we'll learn to walk. We have ears, we'll learn to listen. And that's really where I think there's a huge gap. Even a lot that's out there, including the quotes and that I respect and support my work, which is seek to understand first, that's great, but how do you teach somebody? We're missing a big step here. We're missing how to do it, not just that we're supposed to do it. So I think people are very well-intended, and I know by teaching this and my team from teaching it, even when people are well-intended to listen, they still fail because of that lack of education. Even with good intentions, they still fail.
Thank you again for listening. We pray that you and your family have a blessed holiday season. Don't forget that you too have a something extra. So be sure and share it with your friends, family, and those you encounter in 2023 and beyond.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.